Brian Rosenwald is a political historian of the modern United States with a special interest in the role of media in shaping popular political cultures. He is a scholar in residence at the University of Pennsylvania, where he teaches courses in history and political science. He co-founded and served as senior editor of Made by History, a Washington Post history section. His book, Talk Radio's America, How an Industry Took Over a Political Party That Took Over the United States, was published in fall 2019 and is the subject of today's episode. He is a frequent writer for Public Audiences. He's an avid sports fan and has an active Substack newsletter, which includes a weekly political notes column. Here's Kelly White discussing Talk Radio's America.
Hello, everybody. My name is Kelly White. I'm going to be discussing Talk Radio's America, a book written by historian Brian Rosenwald in 2017. This book is an interesting one, as it touches on the rise of political talk radio shows by the end of the 20th century and the lasting effects these shows have on political culture here in the United States. President Nixon's philosophy on media was to promote economic development and consumer choice, as well as dismantle the influence of national reporters who set the news agenda. President Ronald Reagan took this philosophy one step further, and in 1987, the FCC officially ended the Fairness Doctrine. Fast forward to 2016, however, and we see that these partisan talk shows grew into a powerful political force that created gridlock, hyperpartisanship, disdain for political opposition, and a reformed Republican Party with Donald Trump at its epicenter. I fear America is too far removed from the days of the Fairness Doctrine, and hyperpartisanship is here to stay, especially in the age of social media. Thank you for listening.
Welcome, Brian Rosenwald.
Kate, it's great to be with you.
So, could you talk a little bit about the rise of Rush Limbaugh? And I've always been struck how you incorporate the Fairness Doctrine into your interpretation and tell a bit of a different origin story for Rush and his radio program. But maybe you could use the Fairness Doctrine as a way to get us into where Rush Limbaugh comes from and how he's able to build this media phenomenon.
I think the Fairness Doctrine is very much misunderstood, both what it was, what it did, and the impact the repealing it had. I think the best way of explaining that is to say, you know, Rush Limbaugh did the same basic show in Sacramento for like 3 years while the Fairness Doctrine was still in place. And that was because the Fairness Doctrine just mandated overall balance in a station's handling of controversial issues. So that meant that when Rush Limbaugh was in Sacramento, there was a liberal on in the afternoon. It did not mean that Rush Limbaugh could not say whatever he wanted to say. It did not mean that someone could not say something if it was not factual. It did not mean that you could not have mostly conservative programming. It just meant that you had to have a liberal on there somewhere in the day. A lot of the stations put Alan Colmes on, the late former comedian and Sean Hannity television partner, who was a radio host who was pretty successful at night. It was just about overall balance in a station's program, and it only applied to broadcast radio and broadcast television. Even if the Fairness Doctrine was still in place today, cable news would be whatever it wanted to be because it didn't apply to cable. I think that like people who call for a modern Fairness Doctrine misunderstand what it did. Like you'd still have the Sean Hannitys of the world out there saying whatever they're going to say. You might just have a liberal voice somewhere on their station. I'm not even sure that Fox News would run afoul of the Fairness Doctrine because like they have the panel show The Five and it's four conservatives, but there is one liberal there. Yes, the liberal's job is to take a beating. It's like pro wrestling where they are designed to lose every debate. But the fact is there's still a liberal voice there and that would have complied with what the Fairness Doctrine mandated. The people who say the Fairness Doctrine went away and think it's a major factor basically contend, and I'm talking about people in the radio business, is essentially that owners were skittish while the Fairness Doctrine was in place. They didn't want to deal with complaints. They didn't want to deal, you know, with the possibility of losing their license. So they just didn't do political programming or controversial programming at all. But the fact is, there were plenty of conservative voices on the airwaves while the Fairness Doctrine was in place, from Neil Bortz in Atlanta, going back to the 70s, Bob Grant in New York. There were these people, and you could do the same type of conservative programming that we have today. The only thing that we have today that the Fairness Doctrine would have prevented was what they call format purity, the idea of all conservative stations where you wouldn't have a liberal on just because you wouldn't play Beethoven's Fifth on the country station. Radio programmers believe that people need to know what they're getting when they tune in, and you couldn't have had that kind of all-conservative station. In terms of Limbaugh's rise, it was a complicated combination of a guy being in the right place at the right moment historically, and a guy who was just that talented at doing provocative radio, doing something that people wanted to tune into, even if they tuned in because they wanted to scream at the radio about what he was saying. He gave them a reason to tune in. He was that good. He was that skilled. If you've heard one of the vignettes of him as a DJ in the 70s, he was doing a lot of the same thing, even if it was funny and fun and creative in a way that made the left half of the country say, no, you can't say that. That's racist or that's problematic. It was fun and funny in a way that half of the country thought, hey, this is a guy who I'm entertained by. But he also did take advantage of this moment in which AM radio needed new programming. AM radio was dying in the 80s. And as audiences migrated to listen to FM music stations, advertisers went with them. And AM stations were just not making money. And they needed something unique. And what talk gave them was unique programming that was not dependent upon sounding good. Like the human voice, it doesn't matter if it's AM or FM. So he took advantage of that. And it was also a moment that the culture wars were out there. And more conservatives felt like their views and values were being not just marginalized, but maligned. That haughty liberal elites in Hollywood, the Academy, Democratic Party, you know, were rolling their eyes at them, looking down on them, looking down on what they had always believed. And Limbaugh was somebody who could give them voice. Limbaugh was something who could say the things that they felt like they could no longer say because someone, whether it was their kids, somebody at work was going to say, no, you're racist or you're sexist, or you can't say these things anymore. Limbaugh gave them something that was entertaining, but he was going to stand up for their values. He did one rant one day against gangster rap, saying, you know, the edgy music of my days was the Beatles, you know, talking about love. And now the edgy music of today is this stuff talking about all sorts of awful themes or violence or all this kind of stuff. And it was like having somebody sticking up for you after feeling like somebody was running you down all the time. And that's what people wanted. And so he tapped into a vein in the marketplace that nobody really knew existed. Nobody knew that there was this hunger for conservative media. And I think that includes him, by the way. He was just doing what he thought would be an entertaining radio show. And but it wasn't like we're not talking about a guy who had a political project here. And I think a lot of people miss that. This was a guy who was trying to put on a great show and make a lot of money. And the light bulb went off one day of like, all of these people want to hear the content. They're here for the conservative political message. And that really shaped an entire industry.
So Raymond was really curious about the larger connections between the rise of Rush Limbaugh and conservative talk radio and the broader conservative movement as it's accelerating in the 1980s and into the 1990s. And he brought up the rise of homeschooling at the same time, the role maybe of an economic downturn for some sectors of the American economy, particularly in agricultural areas, perhaps. So how does the rise of talk radio fit into the larger movement landscape? Is it a driver or is it a result?
I think it's both. We have study evidence that like in Limbaugh's earliest days, his audience was also consuming a decent amount of mainstream news. But the fact of the matter was when Limbaugh goes national, the big media is still CBS, ABC, NBC, the nightly news programs. CNN is the only cable news network. And when he goes national in 88, there's still not like this massive force that comes more in the 90s. You've got like the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, Chicago Tribune, and then the wire services. And that's it in terms of national media. And so the message on conservative media helps to drive down faith in mainstream institutions, whether that's universities, whether that's the media, whether that's schools. And so that creates an opening to create infrastructure in the conservative world of homeschooling networks and conservative universities and law schools and things, and more conservative media. So that by the time you get into the early 2000s, the Limbaugh listener is the Fox News viewer. That person is now living in an echo chamber, and it's only gotten worse from there. And I do think that conservative media deserves credit for really reinforcing skepticism on the right about mainstream institutions. It drives down cross-pollination. It drives down places where conservatives and liberals might believe in the same institutions, and it takes conservatives away from mainstream institutions that might counter some of their ideas or counter some of the misinformation that they're getting, or that might give them more balanced pictures of Democrats. What do I mean by that? I mean that, like, you say, well, I disagree with Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, but they're not radicals. Whereas I think one reason Hillary lost in 2016 is that to anybody who had consumed conservative media, going back to 1992, she was almost satanic. She was seen as this, like, truly evil force. So you get to 2016 and you might be someone on the right who has misgivings about Donald Trump's values and whether he's actually a conservative, and you don't like his personal behavior. But to you, he's running against this evil figure. And so you're going to find a way to get to vote for him, in part because conservative media portrayed the Clintons not as, like, center left, but as truly evil. I think it also is a little bit of an accelerant in terms of the conservative movement, especially among blue-collar Americans, because when I talk to Democratic politicians, especially those from rural states, they would say, you know, we have a lot of people who are driving trucks across South Dakota or North Dakota, or who are on farm equipment all day, and this kept them company, and they were getting political messaging. And these are people who were probably always more culturally conservative, but were prairie populists. I think that this can help to convert populism to a more conservative form, but certainly not the only factor. But I do think it played a little bit of a role in that. But mostly, I think it reinforced for people who were already leaning right. It reinforced their values. It maybe pushed them further to the right. And it made politics seem more like a war or zero-sum game, where we better fight because this is existential. This is a crisis.
So Samuel is wondering about why we don't see the same kind of liberal equivalents, or whether maybe the success of somebody like Jon Stewart shows that there are liberal equivalents. And so I'm wondering how you approach that question of why, maybe listeners will remember the Air America liberal talk network. How do you puzzle through that with Samuel of the liberal equivalent to conservative talk radio? Did it ever exist, or can it exist?
So Air America failed for a lot of very specific Air America reasons, like going back to the fact that their founder was a Ponzi scheme guy and they were, like, bouncing checks by week two on the air, and that they had an incredibly ambitious vision that needed the ability to lose like $1 billion over 5 years. And they didn't have anywhere near those kinds of resources. They also brought a lot of people in who did not have experience in radio, and then they threw them together in teams. Like, they didn't even really know each other. And so, like, Air America failed for a lot of reasons that had to do with Air America's business model. But there's three major reasons that we don't have a real equivalent to conservative talk on the liberal side. The first is, I'm not sure that's what liberal audiences want. What a lot of liberal audiences want is the mainstream media. It's NPR. It is content that I think you can fairly say is guided by liberal cultural values and sensibilities in terms of the questions they ask, the stories they report on, and topics they discuss, but where they're trying to provide balance and information, not polemics and screaming, and not angry opinion content. If you conceptualize the Democratic coalition as like a stool, what are the three pillars right now? It is well-educated white professionals who are looking for that NPR-y kind of thing. They want to consume mainstream news where they feel like they're informed, not just somebody cheerleading for their values. They want to feel informed, but from a certain liberal sensibility. They don't care about the same stories that conservatives care about. They want liberal values to shape the questions asked. Then you have minority populations, and there has always been successful urban talk radio formats or African-American talk radio formats. They tend to be a little bit less political. There can be some religious programming. They are more focused on local community issues, but they're still pulling that audience. And then the other pillar is young listeners. Well, there's a lot of content out there for young people from what they call guy talk in the radio business, which is Howard Sterny. It's not particularly political. it can be more sexual. It's attractive more to men, but even more just like hijinks radio that is not political. Again, on FM rock stations, the morning zoo format, where you've got three or four co-hosts who are doing, they have gags and they have contests and they do interviews with entertainment personalities. And it's not really political at all, but it has a very young demographic. And so that pulls that audience away. And so from a money-making perspective, there's not an audience just for this liberal, loud, almost entirely political thing. I also think that a lot of these liberal shows that they've tried over the years, people fundamentally didn't understand that the goal has to be to put a good show on. Rush Limbaugh said, "What is the best show I can do every day?" It's not, how can I drive more people to the Republican Party? It's, what does my audience want to hear today? How can I reflect what they're thinking? How can I give them what they want? How can I put on a good show? And so if you listen to somebody like Al Franken, who is perfectly capable of being entertaining, his radio show was pretty dry. The one guy who really did sort of do that was Jon Stewart. He's doing something unique, and he again is trying to put on a good show. You know, Jon Stewart has spent almost a quarter century at this point saying, I am not a newsman. I am not a political figure. I am an entertainer. I am trying to put on a good show. I am not going to do what you want me to do, people on the left, or be what you want me to be. He did that rally to restore sanity, where he assiduously refused to encourage people to show up and vote in the midterms that were right after that. It's funny. It's fun. It's Donald Trump is just the butt of our jokes, or conservative Republicans are the butt of our jokes. It's not that serious. There is also something that's interesting. I heard this over and over again from people in the radio business. They said, you know, liberal thinking fits talk radio less well. It's much more nuanced. There's gray areas. They would point to Mario Cuomo, who they tried in the 90s. And he was a paradigmatic example of, hey, we're going to pluck somebody from the political world who doesn't know how to do good radio, doesn't understand the skills it takes to do good, entertaining spoken word programming. And people would say to me, he'd make a great point. And they'd say, but on the other hand, and then he'd like demolish his own point. And that's not what people want. They want like pithy sound bites, summarize it in 15 or 20 seconds where you can almost have it's like greatest hits radio. Like if you get in the car and you turn the country station on, you're going to hear the same Morgan Wallen song like four times a day these days, or a Taylor Swift song on a pop station. They want you to be able to hear the political version of that, like low taxes or family values. And they said, you know, liberals didn't really have that. And I was sort of skeptical of that. And then there was a book by a scholar named Danego Goldwith Young. It was the University of Delaware that pointed out that liberals and conservatives think differently about things. Her book was on humor, and what they think is funny is different. And so I think that there may be something to the idea that they want different programming. They have different desires in terms of what content is, and that liberals have tried to mimic what conservatives did, and that they've been much more successful when they tried to do their own thing and innovate in their own way. Whether that was Jon Stewart, whether that is someone like Rachel Maddow, who is much more opinionated version of NPR, I think, where there is that informational component to a much greater extent. Whereas I think that most of the guys on the right are showmen. They are trying to figure out what's going to get us the best ratings today. And I'd be remiss of saying that the other factor in this is that there has never really been real money behind building a liberal network. And without that, you were never going to get a liberal network that worked. And I also think there's been a little bit of bad luck. There was never a Limbaugh who came along at that talent level in radio. There was Jon Stewart in television, but he was trying to do a different thing, and he was much less willing to be seen as openly partisan and political. It was more like, I'm the cynical scold who's going to run all this stuff down because Republicans control everything in power. And he was, you know, it was classic satire. You run down the people in power. There just has not been a liberal who had quite that talent level, who you could build stations around, who could do a decent show. That just didn't exist.
Could you talk about the consequences or the legacies of this, maybe for Democrats and perhaps the role that scandal has played in politics, and for Republicans, as one of the students, Mason, put it, this demand for ideological purity? How do we think about the legacies of conservative media and talk radio, and maybe with a little bit of eye towards what's going to happen potentially in 2024
I could give you a very radio answer, Kate. Five words. Misinformation, echo chambers, and political warfare. The impact of this is that it has driven the country apart. There are some that heard Rush Limbaugh and experienced epiphanies, or some who were apolitical, who they found Limbaugh entertaining and he dragged them into politics on the right. And what it has done is it's radicalized them in a lot of ways. It's convinced them that they're in an existential struggle for the values that they hold dear. And some of this is religious. Some of this, though, is what they saw as bedrock American values that they feel like have been under siege and are being challenged from every direction, from universities, from entertainment content, from Democratic politicians, from the mainstream media. And increasingly, they are trapped in worlds that are entirely conservative. You look at the New York Times did something after 2020 where they broke down the presidential vote by zip code. And most of the zip codes in America were like at least 70% in one direction versus the other. And there are just not a lot of places where liberals and conservatives socialize anymore or where they even come in contact. And they don't get information that might challenge their views. It has also allowed misinformation to flourish because a lot of these personalities are obviously not journalists. They would never admit this, but they don't see themselves as having a responsibility to only give factual information to their audience. As we learned most vividly from the Fox News Dominion lawsuit, where people are saying one thing privately in their text messages to each other and another thing on the air because they don't want to anger their audience. They see themselves as my job is to draw the largest possible audience for the longest possible time. And so hosts are not going to say, I'm sorry, you're all wrong, because they understand that will actually hurt the bottom line. There's a guy named Charlie Sykes, who is an MSNBC contributor now and runs The Bulwark, but he was the leading conservative talk radio host in Wisconsin for like 20 years. And what Charlie discovered in 2016 is when he started saying things that said he was a never Trumper. And when he started trying to say to his audience, what you're saying is just not true. And he would cite them facts. They'd say, Charlie, you told us the New York Times was just liberal trash. Like, why are you quoting that at us? That people didn't care about facts. And that if you tried to be the truth teller, that your audience was going to go away from you. That has allowed a lot of the misinformation, especially about 2020, but also about COVID, to flourish. Because these people are not going to challenge their audiences. They're going to give them what they want. And they understand that what they want is reaffirming their views. These people don't want to believe that Donald Trump lost. They don't want to believe that a clear percentage of Americans repudiated the presidency that they liked. They believe that elites have been willing to stop at nothing for decades to win politically. And so this is all believable. And so I think it's helped fuel misinformation. It's turned politics into warfare, you know. But also, these hosts have no responsibility for governance. These hosts have no responsibility for what is good for American democracy. That's not what they're charged with. They're charged with making money for their companies. And the only real limiting factor, as we saw with Fox and Dominion, is when they say something that is libelous, when they say something that is going to get their bosses sued. If they are able to create something where they can have the same impact while being explicitly ideological and keep making money and avoid things like the Dominion lawsuit, then I think that this is just going to get worse. There's no limiting factors on this. And whatever strictures are left on conservative media are going to go away. I think this is making politics worse. I think it has made people more extreme. It has made things more polarized. But I also think we'd be foolish if we said, this is all conservative media driving this. This is not that we are becoming more and more divided about absolutely everything. A lot of this comes down to we have a very divided country and very divided values. And while I think conservative media stokes that and makes it worse, I don't know that it's driving it. If AM radio dies, if cable television dies, and both of those things are exceedingly possible now, people are going to be more free to build their own networks. And at least for younger Americans, that may include some voices that are at least somewhat on the right. There are probably people who listen to Joe Rogan, who is a modern day Limbaugh in that, and he says a lot of things that infuriate people on the left, but he's not necessarily like a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. He's more of a populist kind of voice. There are probably people on the left who listen to him, but also might like certain voices on the left, whether it's Rachel Maddow, or Chris Hayes on MSNBC, whether it's some left-leaning younger voices that are out there in the podcast sphere, maybe they listen to Pod Save America as well. I'm sure there's some cross-pollination that you can't have in these networks that are built around an ideology. So I think that there is a little bit of hope that if people are essentially building their own networks in terms of what they listen to, that it might cross ideological boundaries or at least be a little bit more eclectic. And we may get back to that, where people are listening to a little bit more diverse content, especially people like under 50. It's not a sure thing, but I think that we're definitely seeing the delivery mechanism is changing. I am not saying this is happening in the next 5 years. I'm not even saying this is happening in the next 10. There are possibilities out there that might make things better for the long term. But I think things are only going to get more toxic in the next 3, 4, 5 years. The politics are only going to get more polarized. I think the culture wars are only going to get worse and spill over into every aspect of life if there's any that they're not in now. And I think the conservative media will be driving this and driving the anger on the right and stoking it, even if they're not causing it, if that makes sense.
So interesting to hear your perspectives and about your research. Thank you so much for joining us, Brian Rosenwald.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Kate.
Hi, my name is Ari Lyons. I'm a PRSA major, and you're listening to Perseverentia, the Fitchburg State Podcasting Network.